According to an ancient piety, our troubled world came into being on the first Rosh Hashanah. Zeh Hayom Haras Olam. This is the day in which God created this world. And as befits any birthday, Rosh Hashanah exudes a mood of warm joy and quiet reflection. But increasingly, I have found myself an outsider to this spirit, a bit reluctant to step across the threshold into the new year. I ask myself, why so? Am I disturbed by the passage of time, by the process of aging? I think not. Does the sudden and change which surrounds me, the revolutionary character of our life, disturb me? Again, I think not. Science and change rather excite me. It is not so much that I fear the future. It is that I fear that there may be no future. One of the oldest nightmares known to man is that of Armageddon, the sudden cataclysmic end to life. We have an Armageddon. But unlike the ancient dream of the four horsemen galloping across the world, spreading death and desolation, ours is not science fiction, but science. The plans of destruction are neatly typed. The buttons of destruction are clearly marked. Computers have spun and they have pinpointed the cities that are to be razed, the millions who are to be cindered, the billions who are to be left starving and homeless. It is all so neatly arranged. And as I face a tomorrow which may include inferno, as we face a tomorrow which may include inferno, I think it is easy to understand why we halt, hold back, and are not quite as eager as we once were to taste the delicacies of the future. And what is our reaction? It is to search out the meaning of history, the drift of history. Are we being channeled towards the precipice, we ask? Or is mankind coming into quieter waters where we will be given the leisure, the opportunity to work out our passions and the revolutions of our time? I do not know. No one knows. The more that we search beyond the curtain that veils tomorrow, the more that we search back and review the history of today, the more it seems to us that we are moving towards progress and towards destruction, towards peace and towards Armageddon at one at the same time. There is greater freedom, but equally there is greater belligerency. There are peace corps in our world, but for every volunteer, 10 men are conscripted into some army. We have produced great prosperity, but such is the explosion of our population that there is even greater want than ever before. We manage to muddle through each succeeding crisis, but crisis piles upon crisis, one more exacerbating than the next, one coming closer on the heels than the next than ever before. We have met the problems as of now. Men are energetic, but we are not quite sure how long we will maintain our control over the confusions and the chaos of the day. And so we face the future, you and I, with mixed anticipation. But if we search out, puzzle out the meaning of our day, one truth shines through. One truth calls out to be listened to. One truth can give, I think, a great measure of hope. And it is this. that we will sculpt our own destiny, that there is nothing inevitable about the future except the inevitable price we must pay for our follies and the inevitable prize that can be ours if we are single-minded and if we are strong. Neither the heavens nor human nature conspire against us. We determine blessing or suffering, life or death, the judgment of the new year. Many an ancient philosophy and biology, my friend, teaches other. Many an ancient biology and philosophy insists that man is a superficially civilized jungle animal, and that ultimately, in a moment of crisis, when man is confronted and must be heroic or ignoble, ultimately, the primitive passion comes through. Translated into the usual theology, there is a soul stain in man, some concept, some burden of original sin that hobbles us. And ultimately, when we seek to achieve, we cannot achieve. Our arm is too short. We lack the power. The longer that I am privileged to live, the more I am convinced of the untruth, the utter falsity of this view. The badge of the human race, my friends, is not depravity, but decency. Goodness and gentleness are the attributes of mankind. And there is no social problem which faces us, which, given the skills of our hand and the powers of our minds and the depth of our understanding, is ultimately beyond our solution. Decency is the badge of the human race. Oh, it may be well for our literary people who delight in a mood of self-pity, to image man as a ship of fools sailing backwards from the new challenges to old worlds and old wars and old hates, to people the ship with the despondent and the broken and the dispirited and the distraught of our world. It is good literature, but it is not drawn from life. The little man who cowers in his box and he looks out about us and curses us and says, man is to be damned, man is no good. This little man has walled himself in. He is sick. It is not mankind that is sick. Mankind is a shipload of decent, honorable human beings. All that mankind needs are clear-eyed captains and competent navigators. And if we have these, we too will reach most pleasant anchorage. Do you doubt this? What is mankind? You are mankind. You and those you know and you love. The father who gave you vigor. The father who taught you the meaning of honor. The father whose actions and whose ambitions excited yours. He is mankind. The mother whose love taught you the meaning of sacrifice. The mother whose spirit informed you as to the meaning of sympathy. The mother who forever ingrained on your heart the law of kindliness. She is mankind. And so is the husband you respect. And so is the wife you adore who warms your heart. So is the teacher whose gentleness strengthens your child. So is the doctor whose skill heals your wound, so is the friend whose presence warms your loneliness. This is mankind. Change the color of the skin, move up or down in the scale of economic worth, cross the continents, change the tongue and the speech. It matters not. Go wherever you will in our world, in the poorest of hamlets, in the most modern of cities, and you will find men and women exactly like those you know, with whom you are intimate, exactly like those you love. These are the mass, these are man, these are the creatures created in God's image. Oh, but you say, what of evil? What of the prideful and the powerful and those who flaunt their authority? What of the greedy? What of the lustful? What of the vengeful? What of the violent? How can you dismiss these? The body, my friends, can be ill, and so can human nature. These men are diseased, their souls are diseased, their nature is diseased. But nature is not coeval with evil itself. Nature, as our prayer book says, the soul which thou, O Lord, hast given unto me came pure from thee. Thou hast created it. Human nature can be disturbed. Human nature can be thwarted. Human nature can become diseased if its environment is diseased, if the body is a broken vessel. But the essential man, the man we know, the man who has built civilization, the man who has ultimately overcome evil is good, created in God's image. How else would civilization have arisen out of the primal slime? For evil, my friends, has a doubled and tripled power far beyond its own. A few guns can hold the city at bay. If man were not innately good, if the most debased slave in his prisoner's pit did not whisper to his son of the hope of freedom and did not reach down and help sustain one whose wounds were even more blistering than his own, if mankind had not within him this urge, this urgency, this innate sense of goodness, we would not have overcome the challenges and the obstacles which history has placed. We would not have come to this high pinnacle of civilization. For what is civilization but the extraordinary achievement of ordinary people? And what is extraordinary about civilization is that it is at all. That civilization is at all. It ought not to be. There have always been men who have sought to impose their will, to keep men under their heel, crushed and broken. And their power has been great. And the power of good, the power of saintliness, is often far less great. But mankind has pushed forward. Mankind has overcome. Mankind has overwhelmed. This is what ought to give us a sense of confidence. And this is what ought to give us a sense of urgency, for how often we have heard that ultimate excuse and justification of unmanliness. You can't change human nature. The argument is one about open housing in our communities. We excuse our own participation in the cake of custom which establishes restriction. Why, we say, you can't change human nature. Next year, perhaps, in a generation, but not now, and not for me. The discussion is one of welfare for the indigent in our community. The need is urgent, and we excuse our indifference on the grounds that, after all, we can't rehabilitate these people. Social workers have tried. Why should we bestir ourselves for them? You can't change human nature. And it is true, my friends, you can't change human nature, and how grateful we ought to be to God for this. For human nature has one knowledge out of a dumb universe. Human nature has established justice and just laws. Human nature has created religion and morality. Human nature has built art and culture and civilization. If you could change human nature, if you could debase it, if you could render it brute and devilish, all our dreams would be at naught. But because you can't, because ultimately man is good and hopes for the good things, we have reason to believe that what we aspire can be achieved, that men can be educated, that the ancient prejudices can be erased. We have reason to hope for the future. Here, too, I think, comes our answer to the most perplexing problem which confronts any of us. We hope for peace. We dream of peace. But we ask ourselves honestly, what can I contribute? What can I contribute that will quiet the problems of this troubled world? I am no prince. I am no commissar nor president. I do not control the political destinies of mankind. My vote is pitifully meaningless. What can I do? You remember the child's poem? How for want of a nail in the shoe of a horse, because of the carelessness of a blacksmith, the battle was lost, and the fate of Europe was decided. War is not determined ultimately, my friends, in the chancelleries of the world, because we bear responsibility for those who are placed in power, who occupy those chancelleries. And it is our passion or dispassion, our reason or our emotion, our prejudice or our clear-eyed vision, which establishes the broad limits within which such people may operate and exert their power. Hitler unloosed the panzers on Europe, to be true. But the medieval prejudices of the German people, the religions of a German people which was of the next world but not of this, the academics of the German people who believed that truth belonged in an ivory tower but not in the marketplace, the mothers of Germany who dreamt of martial glory and honor for their children, the Junkers of Germany who dreamt of the reconsecrated vision of Germany overall, the burghers of the German communities who allowed themselves to be coerced to shout with a mob, who refused to have independent judgment in matters of economics and politics. These ultimately bear the blame, the responsibility for Hitler. For had it not been for their compromises and their indecision, their weakness and their prejudice, Hitler would have remained an unknown psychopath in an Austrian hospital. It is ultimately we, by our abidance of principle, by our acceptance of civic virtue, by our passion for civic improvement, by our impatience with ancient prejudice, by our determination to improve the economic lot of all, by our belief and practice of principle, by our intolerance of evil, by our unwillingness to participate in the chorus of emotion which the hidden persuaders again and again unloose across our land. It is we, by being ourselves, by maintaining independence of judgment, control of the facts, by abiding a law of service to our community, by accepting the responsibilities of goodness and morality, it is we who will determine whether there be war and peace, whether there be justice or injustice abroad in our world. Rosh Hashanah, dear friends, would be a pointless holiday if man was ultimately not responsible for the fate of his life and his society. And Rosh Hashanah points up clearly and unmistakably the extent of our responsibility. What is the legend of Rosh Hashanah? God is in his heavens. He sits on the throne of judgment. Before him an open ledger, in his hand a quill. He writes each name of man on one page or the other, for life or for suffering, for blessing or for death. And what determines God's judgment? Before him there is a scale. Into the one hand pan is poured our good deeds and our accomplishments. Into the other, our failings and our weaknesses. As the measure of the scale, so the measure of our destiny. So the ancient legend. And what is the symbol behind this legend? It is clear to all. We determine ultimately, if we live or if we die. We determine the folly or the truth, the honor or the dishonor which will be abroad in our world. God, the ancient legend says, created many a world before he was satisfied enough with one to allow man to be born into it. There is power sufficient, resource sufficient, plenty in abundance in our world, if man organize his energies and develop intelligently his resource. And what of man himself? Are there any bars within man? Any instincts so primeval, so devilish, that ultimately we will be caught short? That we will thwart our own best intentions? No. Man is created in the image of God. God does not have eyes, hands, feet, a mouth to speak. God is a symbol of goodness. God is the symbol of mercy and of generosity, of honor and of truth. This is sealed within us. We can discipline these virtues, bring them out, refine them, develop them. If we have the will, if we are determined. Rosh Hashanah, my friend, speaks with an urgency, the imperative of action. Prophecy, the prophecy of our Bible, speaks in the same vein. Why? The prophet Zechariah spoke of Israel as being the Asirei HaTikva, the prisoners of hope. And the phrase is apt. We read of hope this morning. It shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains. And every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts shall have spoken. This is our hope. It is embedded in our Bible. It is embedded in our hearts. It is embedded in the life instinct of man. We are shackled to this hope. Shackled to it because of our sure knowledge that it will not be established in and of itself. We cannot sit back and wait and say, God will take care of it for us. The responsibility is ours now, not someone else's, but our own. Not tomorrow, but today. Cease to do evil. Establish justice. Proclaim freedom. These are the imperatives of Rosh Hashanah. These are the imperatives, the bases of Judaism. These are the basis of our hope. We read this morning, as we have read every Rosh Hashanah these past many generations, the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. It is a strange story indeed, and with it I close. God commands Abraham, his first disciple, to take his son, his only son, Isaac, to offer him up on Mount Moriah as a sacrifice to God. Now, many have complained about the cruelty of this demand. Many have wondered why such a story be in our Bible. And if it were history, we would well wonder at it. But it is not, of course. It is legend. A legend which contains within it a great universal truth. Abraham is a symbol of mankind. God demands of each of us great sacrifice. The sacrifice of our whole lives for what could be more precious to us than a son. What is more precious to us than our honor? What is more precious to us than the lives of our children? He demands this sacrifice of us. And what is the conclusion of this story? A ram appears caught in the thicket near the place of sacrifice, a surrogate, a gift, a miracle from God, in place of the boy. The ancients knew that in the end, weeping would dissipate itself, and there would be the dawning of joy. But they could not imagine that this dawn would come about except through God's miraculous intervention. We need God's help. But we, my friends, are a generation which, were we to rewrite this story, could rewrite it in humanistic terms. We have made poverty obsolete. We have made want obsolete. We are about to make unnecessary pain and illness obsolete. We have it within our power to make ignorance obsolete. Would it not be the most tragic end of all if after tens of thousands of generations of growth and hope, of sacrifice, man on the verge of the utopia of utopias, man on the verge of the day for which he has for millennia dreamed, if man would suffer such a failure of nerve that he could not persevere, walk the last steps, open the door, and enter into a world of justice liberty, honor, religion, and peace. Ze hayom haras olam. This is the day on which God created this world. In creating life, he gave us blessing. In creating life, he gave us challenge. On this birthday of the world's creation, let us proudly accept that challenge. Amen.